Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and we are here for the Creating a Vibrant Life radio show. And I am really, really excited about my special guest today, and I'll share with you in just a moment who that is and give you some background, and you're in for a really big treat today. So just to give you an idea, this show is broadcast every Thursday at 10 a.m. Central Time and bright and early at 8 a.m. in the Pacific. And we are dedicated to providing you in the best of information to help you to live a vibrant life, to help you to overcome some of those standard American, standard Western world issues that plague people and don't need to plague people. And the call today is all about gluten, and this is the first in a series of four calls, four radio shows that we will be doing on this topic. We broadcast live from Austin, Texas, usually. Next week we will be broadcasting a recorded call because I will be traveling. And so today's call is part one of our gluten series. And gluten, as you may have heard, is, you know, been in the press all the time. You can't go into a supermarket anymore without seeing, oh, here's the gluten-free aisle, and we have gluten-free this and gluten-free that. And a lot of people think, well, what is this gluten-free stuff? Is this just the latest fad in nutrition, or is there really something to it? So I have with me today someone who is a foremost expert on the topic of gluten. His name is Dr. Thomas O'Brien, and he is an internationally recognized speaker and a workshop leader, and his specialty is gluten sensitivity and celiac disease. His website, thedoctor.com, is dedicated to being a resource to help people to find out how gluten affects them and overcome that. He also holds faculty positions with the Institute of Functional Medicine, the National University of Science, and also on the IAACN, the International and American Association of Clinical Nutritionists. And I first heard Dr. Tom speak many years ago, probably 8 or 10 years ago, I'm thinking, at one of the IAACN, which is the International Association of Clinical Nutritionists, conferences that I had missed. But I had purchased the recordings, and I was listening, and his talk about gluten was stunning, and the research that he had dug up was amazing, and it just really inspired me to look more closely at the role of gluten in my own practice and working with people, and has really turned me around into that gluten is a really big piece of how I help people to get well. So, without further ado, I would love to introduce you to Dr. Thomas O'Brien.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to be here. We have a lot of people calling in today, more people than ever, so I will tell you that we've got a hot topic here.
Yes.
So, first of all, I really want to get into gluten sensitivity, your definition of what it is and how it differs from celiac disease. But before that, just a little brief intro on how did you get interested in gluten? It just seems like, wow, all of a sudden, you know, this guy who's in clinical practice and he decides he's going to just focus on this one area called gluten. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that and then maybe flow into what the heck is this celiac disease and gluten sensitivity.
Okay, well, in 2001, I heard a presentation by a neurologist, a friend named David Perlmutter from Naples, Florida. And Dr. Perlmutter was talking about a new article that had just come out in the journal Neurology. And this study was on 10 patients that had unrelenting migraines. That meant that they didn't go away. And the average was, with these 10 patients, they had been suffering for 8 years with unrelenting migraines, meaning almost every day they've got a migraine. They couldn't work. They were all in workman's compensation, and so you know that they weren't malingerers. These people were really suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And as he talked about this, I started thinking about what's it like to be a child living in that house. I don't know why, but I did. You know, it's like, shh, 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 Dad's got a headache. Shh, shh, quiet. And what kind of suppression had to be occurring for these children, and how did it feel for a man or a woman, well, usually a man, who wasn't able to work. He couldn't provide for his family. They were living off their life savings and their retirement accounts, and they were living on workman's comp. I mean, I made this all up in my head, the vision of what it was like to be in that family. I ordered that out, and Dr. Perlmutter said all 10 of them were sent to a neurologist who identified gluten sensitivity, not celiac disease, gluten sensitivity. The doctor put him on a gluten-free diet. 7 out of 10 never had a headache again. 2 out of 10 got partial relief, and the 10th one refused the diet. So that just dropped my jaw, and he showed the MRIs, and all these people had lesions in the brain. That's like scar tissue in the brain from eating wheat. And so I ordered that paper. I read that paper, and in the back of the research paper are all the references of other articles, and I ordered a number of those articles, and I was off and running, and that was in 2001. And finally, by 2003, I was seeing this in my practice every day, every single day. And I said, you know, I've got to get this word out. I just felt the desire to do that. So I made a declaration. I'm going to start teaching healthcare practitioners about what these studies say, because so many of my friends didn't know about this. Right. So I made a declaration I was going to do that. And the first presentation I ever gave to a professional healthcare group was the one that you were listening to. The IAACN in 2004. That was my first presentation on this topic. Since then, I've been I sold my practice, and I teach this full time. I travel the world. Just came back from London 3 days ago, where the reception was marvelous. Everyone wants to hear about this when they see the science behind it. When they see this is not a fad, and that there's over 18,000 research articles in the medical literature on the problems with gluten for some people. Now, what is gluten sensitivity? You asked me to flow into that. That's a really good question, because there's been so much confusion over the years as to how do you call this thing, what is it, what's the differences. The International Celiac Symposium occurs every 2 years, and recently it was in June of just last year in Oslo, and a consensus group from that conference came out with a paper just 3 weeks ago on the nomenclature for celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. They've requested, and all the experts agree, this is the way to look at this problem. Here's how you're going to look at it from now on, so that we all are talking the same language. We're all talking about apples and different types of apples when we talk about gluten sensitivity. Great. So the umbrella term that covers all of it, the umbrella term is gluten-related disorders. Oh. That's just a general catch-all. If it affects your intestines and you've got the genetics and it affects your intestines and your intestines get damaged and you get what's called villus atrophy, and perhaps we'll talk about that, that's called celiac disease. But on the other side, if it does not affect your intestines, it's called non-celiac gluten sensitivity. And in non-celiac gluten sensitivity, it may affect your intestines, it may affect your brain, it may affect your gallbladder, it may affect your muscles, it may affect your bones, it may affect your eyes. It may affect the nerves in your brain, you get MS, or it may affect your joints and you get arthritis. So there are many, many different manifestations under the umbrella of non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So that's the way to look at it, is either celiac or non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and the numbers are startling that it's well accepted that for every one case of celiac, you're going to find at least 6 cases of non-celiac gluten sensitivity, at least. And some papers say more, but there's an agreement that at least 6-to-1 ratio that is going to manifest more often, not as celiac, but as non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
Wow. So it just about affects just about every organ system in the body.
That's exactly right.
What percentage of the population would you estimate, and not so much to, you know, from your studies, of course, but also from your actual practical experience, how many people, you know, how many people are affected by this?
You know, when we I just looked at the numbers yesterday. I've been accumulating data for a few years, and it looks like somewhere around 30 to 40% of the people that come into the office with some kind of physical complaint, whatever it is, about 3 or 4 out of 10 will have antibodies to one of the peptides of gluten. So it's about 30 to 40% in my clinical experience that I see.
Wow.
And depending on the group that you look at, is it elderly, is it family members of someone with celiac, depending on the group, the numbers are anywhere from 1 in 100 to 1 out of every 5. So it just depends on what group you're looking at. But clinically, it's about 30 to 40%, about 3 or 4 out of every 10 people.
Yeah, because there's so many people who are running around. Most of the people that have said, hey, I've got this problem, I need to have some help, and have shown up in your office. There are so many people that are showing up in doctors' offices all over the world with all kinds of vague complaints, and they're either told it's all in your head and given Prozac, or they're told we don't know what it is, take some anti-inflammatories, or they're given some kind of knockoff diagnosis or non-diagnosis. So
yes.
I think that the prevalence is huge. And
yes.
in my clinical practice, I would say that, you know, I would say it's even more than 30 to 40% because of the kinds of cases that I generally see. So, yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
And that's an unbelievable number of people that are coming through. And it doesn't matter if you're a rheumatologist, a dermatologist, a neurologist, a cardiovascular specialist, a general practitioner, a pediatrician, a gerontologist. It doesn't matter your specialty, that when you start looking for this, you're going to see it so frequently as a contributing component to whatever the symptoms are that a person is coming in with. It's kind of like it's the trigger. It's the trigger that's going to manifest wherever your genetic weak link is.
Yep, yep. That's a good way of looking at it, wherever your genetic weak link is, because we all have slightly different genetics. And when I was fascinated and inspired after listening to your talk to research, and I wrote a research paper for one of my certification things and got published, was on the role of gluten in neurodevelopmental diseases, disorders, meaning like autism and ADD and those sorts of things. And I was just floored by the research, but I kept seeing as I'm doing my research, you know how that goes. You're looking at articles. Oh, there's one on schizophrenia. Oh, there's one on, you know, dermatitis. Oh, there's one on, and there were just this huge
yes.
compendium of papers out there on different systemic manifestations of gluten
yes.
intolerance. But
yes.
the question that
yes.
people ask all the time is like, okay, this is a food, right? This food hasn't wheat and gluten been around for centuries? Why is it that this one food in our food chain is so problematic?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, some people phrase it and say, it's in the Bible. It's in the Bible.
Yes.
It's good for us. And
yeah.
my response is, you know, with all due respect, no one on the planet is eating the bread that Jesus Christ ate. Show me that bread, and we've got a different discussion. But what's happened is that the wheat has been hybridized. They've changed it so much that actually the genetic structure of it has changed. It used to be a tall plant, and the top of the plant, the seeds would develop, and they would get heavy, and the plant would fall over and break, and it wouldn't come to full maturity, where they've hybridized it over the last 50 years, and it's saved millions of lives, millions and millions of lives, because they can harvest more wheat per acre on the shorter dwarf wheat that has been developed. It grows much better. It doesn't fall over and break, and then you lose any harvesting because the plant died. And it saved millions and millions of lives. But the problem is our bodies can't digest it. Our bodies can't digest this hybridized form. It's called the 50-50 rule. In the last 50 years, the gluten content of wheat has gone up by 50%. Now, gluten means glue. And what they do with this product, and this is true, word for word is true, I know in Poland, some of my patients who came from Poland say they take wheat flour, they mix it with water, and they use it as the paste for wallpaper. And it holds wallpaper on the wall for years. And we think that we can eat this, throw it into our guts, and our body's somehow going to take it and use it as healthy 2x4s and bricks and mortar to make strong bodies, strong muscle, strong bones. That it's very, very difficult for the human digestive system to take this food in and accept it as something that's good for us.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't make us sick when we eat it, we think it's okay. Well, the same thing can be said about McDonald's. Oh, excuse me, we're on the air. About fast foods. The same thing can be said about fast foods. That, well, you know, it doesn't make me sick when I eat it. It must be good for me. But if you ever watch the movie Supersize Me, there was a young man who decided to eat nothing but fast food for 30 days, and nothing, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, fast food. And if they offered him a supersize, he'd always say yes, and he'd eat it. And he went to the doctor every week during this month, and the doctor's blood test showed that this kid was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. He went into a depression. By 3 weeks, the doctor said, you have to stop this or you're going to die. Your liver enzymes are going up. This is a movie. It's a great movie to watch.
Right,
because
it's a great movie, yeah.
It's an OMG. But it doesn't make you sick when you eat fast food, so if you think that therefore it's okay for you, you're missing the boat, and it's going to cause problems for you.
Right.
That's exactly the way it is with gluten, that for the vast majority of people, our bodies can't digest it, you can't break it down, and it causes subtle problems. It causes a bonfire in your body, and that's called inflammation.
Right.
Wherever that inflammation shows itself is where your genetic weak link is.
That's awesome. And then the cool part about it is when you make that correlation with the supersize me, it makes sense. It's like it's the bioaccumulation, if you will, of it. Like the first time you ate it when you were a kid, nothing happened, but it's this accumulation and this constant exposure that causes all these problems to get worse and worse and worse until they show up. And then when you remove it and put it back in, then that's when you feel pretty darn sick right away.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So one of the questions that come up all the time is people say, well, what about, you know, since it's hybridized, what about if we go to those ancient forms like kamut or spelt or some of those things? Can you address that a little bit?
Yes, that's a really valid question. And if the first time a child is ever exposed to any gluten, it's to one of the very early monohybrid types, and even if the child has a genetic vulnerability, the possibility is that the immune system would not get activated and think that this is a problem. It's possible. It's theoretical. No one's shown this to be true. But once you've been exposed to it and your immune system says, this is a problem, this is not good for me, our bodies make something, the immune system makes something called memory B cells. Memory B cells are your vigilant guards that are there to protect you the rest of your life. That's what vaccinations are. You get a vaccination for measles, your body starts making antibodies to the bug measles to kill it off.
Mm-hmm.
And when all those bugs from the initial shot are gone, your body stops making antibodies. You shouldn't have antibodies to measles in your bloodstream right now unless you've been exposed. But you've got a cell called the memory B cell for measles that's going to be vigilant the rest of your life. If you're ever exposed to measles, the bug, then that memory B cell just turns on the assembly line to start making more soldiers. You don't have to rebuild the assembly line again.
Mm.
That's why if you go to Africa, you need vaccinations months and months ahead of time before you go for yellow fever and dengue fever, you know, all these unusual things that we're not used to because your body has to make antibodies. But if you go back to visit 5 years later again, you just need a booster shot 2 weeks before you go. You just have to wake up the system because it's already there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were exposed to the original, to the types of wheats we're eating today initially, and if your immune system started making antibodies to it, you've got memory B cells to it. And the memory B cells can't tell the difference between the hybridized type of wheat we eat today and the earlier forms of wheat. The amino acid structures are too similar. And so your memory B cells turn on the assembly line, your immune system starts making the antibodies, and then here come the problems in your liver, or in your kidney, or in your brain, or in your muscles, wherever your genetic weak link is.
Got it. Okay, that makes so much sense. That makes a lot of sense. So that would be true of things like the other components that have, like rye or whatever else contains it. So go run through really quickly for people. What foods contain gluten?
Oh, my goodness, it's shocking. It's really shocking. The most common one that one may be exposed to that we wouldn't think about is soy sauce, that there's wheat in soy sauce, and it doesn't have to be there. It's just a filler, so you have to get wheat-free soy sauce, and then you're fine. And restaurants that have wheat-free menus or gluten-free menus, if they have Oriental-type foods, they will use gluten-free soy sauce to make your Oriental dish, and you can eat everything else that everyone else eats. You just have to be sure of getting the right type of soy sauce.
That's a big one, Tom, because I noticed that people will go gluten-free and they think they're gluten-free, and then they just suddenly I've been off of this for a while, and suddenly I'm getting these symptoms again. And when I dig, it's off. I went to this restaurant. Did you ask about the soy sauce? No. And
it'll turn
out that it was just a little exposure to soy sauce that, promotes the whole cascade again.
Yeah, and it takes less than 1/90th. Of a slice of bread, less than 1/90th, that's 9-0, of a slice of bread to reactivate the memory B cells.
Wow,
So just the subtlest little bit can cause that whole inflammatory cascade to begin again, and then you've got antibodies for 6 to 8 weeks from one exposure.
Wow. And I heard it, I think you were the first person that I heard it say it, was that it could last for 6 months or more. And I heard you say that on a talk once, that it could even be more than 6 months.
Yes, so some of the antibodies can last longer. If someone's hypervigilant, they can be sick for a long, long time, for 6 to 8 months. Even there's some studies show even as long as a year from a single exposure.
So people that come in to me and say, no, I've been gluten-free. Well, really gluten-free, 100%? Well, no, not 100%. But, I have it maybe once a month or a couple of times a month. They're never getting into that state where they're, everything's calmed down, right? That's what it seems like.
One of the probably the biggest danger if you have a gluten sensitivity is not what gluten does. It's what your body, your immune system does as a result of being exposed to gluten. That there's something called a cross-reactivity, and your body starts making antibodies to wherever your genetic weak link is. Once again, it might be your brain, or it might be your bones, and you get osteoporosis, or it might be in your muscles, and you get your muscles start getting weaker and weaker and weaker. It might be your skin, and you get psoriasis. And when you stop gluten exposure, the psoriasis goes away.
Mm.
So the danger is not so much about a tummy ache when you're exposed to gluten. The danger is those memory B cells get turned on. They, in turn, turn on the antibodies to your brain. And so you keep getting more brain damage as a result of this. And you feel fine. You can't tell when your brain cells are being killed off. Until there's a substantial amount of them that have occurred, and now all of a sudden you're getting symptoms of depression. Or now all of a sudden you're getting a diagnosis of attention deficit disorder. Or now all of a sudden you're getting seizures, epilepsy. Or now all of a sudden you get a diagnosis of Parkinson's. Or now all of a sudden you're getting migraines. And it just goes on and on and on. Mm. It's study after study after study that shows the possible symptoms. The symptoms are determined by your genetic vulnerability and your lifestyle accumulations. The trauma that's occurred, the heavy metals you've got in your body and all of that.
It's mind-boggling. I know you're the first person I heard to speak about the connection with Parkinson's and even Alzheimer's. So when you take someone off of gluten and they're presenting with a neurologic problem, how long does it generally take before you'll see changes, before you say, wow, okay, I feel
better?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. 3 weeks. It only takes 3 weeks for most people to see a change and notice that they're feeling better. That's not that you're fine and everything's okay in 3 weeks, but just that you should notice a change. Something's moving in the right direction if you're doing it comprehensively. And that's the problem, is that people go off gluten, but they keep eating other foods that they have sensitivities to. And perhaps in one of the other shows, we'll talk about cross-reactivity.
Right. Yeah, I want to do that on the next one, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, but in general, you should notice something different within 3 weeks. Shouldn't take too long at all.
Okay, 3 weeks. Good. And then there was another question that comes up to me all the time. So when I wanted to talk quickly about you mentioned some of the neurologic stuff. Are the neurologists, in your opinion, do neurologists, are they more aware of this these days? Are more and more people saying, oh, hey, this might be a gluten sensitivity, or you think it's still the dark ages when it comes to that?
That's a really good question. And as a category, every discipline is finding more and more of their members are writing papers and publishing papers about the impact of gluten on their particular specialty, whether it's neurology or cardiovascular disease or liver specialists, hepatologists, or physiatrists and the muscles and bones. Every discipline is finding more of their members who are reading and trying this out and saying, oh, my God, this really is happening to a substantial percentage of my people. And then they publish case studies about MS and gluten sensitivity, or neuromyelitis optica, which is a problem in the eyes that kind of mimics MS. That's gluten sensitivity, or in the Journal of Attention Disorders, they looked at 132 children diagnosed with attention deficit. They all had gluten sensitivity. They put them on a gluten-free diet, and every child within 6 months reported, either the child or their parents reported improvement in all 12 markers, the DSM-4 markers of attention deficit. Every marker, fails to pay attention, can't sit still, interrupts frequently, blurts out answers. All 12 markers improved in every child on a gluten-free diet, 132 kids.
Every child, holy cow. Yeah.
Every child, every marker. What if that was a drug? It'd be on the front page of every paper in the country.
It
and
would?
There'd be many, many school districts demanding that disruptive children take this drug. But this is not a drug. It's just a way of eating.
Right.
And there's no profit to be made in it, so no one is marketing this. And so our specialists in attention deficit don't know about this because they talk to the salespeople that bring them in studies to read, and the studies, they cherry-pick the studies to get the doctors thinking about the areas they want them to think about. So we really need salespeople going out to doctors' offices, bringing them the studies on what the impact is of a gluten-free diet, like reversing Alzheimer's. In the American Journal of Gastroenterology, in 2008, they showed two patients that were checked out of an Alzheimer's facility because they came back to function again. Two patients from Alzheimer's.
Wow. Yeah, that's considered a death sentence. You're there, you're done.
That's right.
Gone.
That's right. Now, I'm not saying that every Alzheimer's patient has gluten sensitivity,
no.
But it's such a simple test to check and see. When would you not want to check? What child with attention deficit would you not want to check, given the Journal of Attention Disorders says every child improves? If they have this problem, you put them on a gluten-free diet, every child improves in every marker.
Wow.
What child would you not check?
Right.
So
exactly.
This is how I talk to the doctors in my seminars. I just show them the studies. I put the studies up on the screen, and then I say, what person are you not going to check for this problem? For example, the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2006 said, we have no hesitancy saying that every patient with osteoporosis should be checked for celiac disease, as celiac disease could be the cause of their osteoporosis. So I show them that study with the exact quote, and I say, so docs, what person with osteoporosis are you not going to check, given that the Annals of Internal Medicine say that everyone should be checked? And they just sit there. They just sit there, you know, and their jaws kind of drop. Say, I never knew this. I'm going to think about this now.
This is good. Well, we have about 3 minutes left on this show. We have part two, just to let you guys know. There's part two coming up, and that will be next week on the 22nd. And we're going to go through how do you test. Because Dr. O'Brien was just saying, who would you not test? So what's the test? You know, oftentimes the biggest test, the easiest test, is just take them off the gluten and see how they do. But you find that a lot of parents are going to fight that tooth and nail. I'm not taking my kid off gluten unless I have to, prove it to me. And so we'll talk about the various tests, which ones are accurate, which ones aren't, which ones it's actually dangerous to check because there's too many false negatives. And we'll get into that. But we only have a few minutes left, so I want to have you mention a couple of things. I know that you're going to be speaking in Austin and San Antonio, so I'd like you to share with people a little bit about that. And how they can get in touch with you if they want more information. And do you have a book?
I do not have a book. I'm so bad at writing books. I've started it so many times, and it's not my forte, but I'm working on it. But I've got DVDs that talk about this in great detail.
Right, and I have your DVDs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So tell them how they can get a hold of you, how they can get more information, how they can get a hold of your DVDs, or also attend your lectures.
My website is thedr.com, thedoctor.com, and if you go there, you'll look under the tab, Where in the World is Dr. O'Brien? And you'll find that I'm in San Antonio on Wednesday night, the 21st, at the Methodist Stone Oak Hospital. And this is for the general public from 7 to 9, that's Wednesday, the 21st. On the 22nd, I'm in Austin. And that's at the Holiday Inn Northwest Arboretum from 5 to 9. We're doing 4 hours. From 5 to 7 is for the general public. 7 to 9 is for practitioners. And both can come to both, and you'll meet doctors who know about this. And so we'll be talking in much more detail about these topics. That's
awesome.
San Antonio on the 21st, Austin on the 22nd. They're listed on the website, thedoctor.com, thedr.com.
Well, thank you, everybody, for being here today. Tune in again next week, Thursday, the same time, same station, and we'll have part two of this fascinating call. And it sounds like from all that we're learning, we probably need to have parts three and four as well. But go visit thedoctor.com, attend the lecture if you can, and, you know, really take this seriously. This topic is a major health issue. So this is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo. Have an awesome, awesome day.